In the shadowy realm between myth and reality lies Anne Rice's Prince Lestat and the Realms of Atlantis, a work that has captivated millions with its blend of vampire lore and ancient civilizations. This 11th installment in the Vampire Chronicles series arrived in 2016 to the delight of fans who had waited years for Rice to return to her beloved vampires. The novel became an instant New York Times bestseller, with celebrities like Cher and Neil Gaiman publicly praising its bold expansion of vampire mythology. What makes this work particularly fascinating is how it connects Rice's supernatural universe to the enduring mystery of Atlantis, a cultural touchstone that has fascinated humanity for millennia. As we explore this rich tapestry of immortality, ancient spirits, and lost civilizations, we discover that beneath the supernatural elements lies a profound meditation on belonging, purpose, and the meaning we create in an endless existence. The vampire mythology in Rice's universe begins with ancient spirits, invisible, ethereal beings that only the most powerful witches could perceive and communicate with. In the fertile valleys of Mount Carmel, the powerful twin witches Makare and Maharet served as spiritual leaders of their people, maintaining a deep connection with these mysterious entities. Among these spirits, one named Amel showed particular interest in human affairs and possessed the unique and disturbing ability to draw blood from humans through invisible wounds. When Queen Akasha of Kemet, ancient Egypt, learned of the twins' powers, she sent soldiers to capture them and destroy their ancestral valley. This act of aggression set in motion a cascade of events that would forever alter the supernatural world. Amel, enraged by the destruction of his favorite witch's homeland, sought vengeance against the Egyptian monarchy. During a palace conspiracy, as assassins plunged their knives into Queen Akasha, Amel seized this violent moment to merge with her dying blood, creating an entirely new form of life, the first vampire. The blood transformation spread rapidly but selectively. Kaiman, Akasha's loyal steward, received the dark gift and subsequently passed it to the imprisoned twins. However, fate would separate the sisters when they were cast adrift on different seas. Maharet eventually found her way to familiar shores, while Makare disappeared across vast oceans, beginning a separation that would last millennia. A profound change occurred when Akasha and her husband Enkil, the first vampires, fell into a mysterious state of suspended animation, becoming living statues. This led to the formation of a sacred priesthood dedicated to their protection, founded on the belief that their destruction would trigger the death of all vampires, a theory known as the blood link. This sacred duty eventually passed to Marius, a Roman scholar turned vampire, who vigilantly guarded them for 2,000 years in various secret sanctuaries. The vampire world was irreversibly altered in 1985 when Lestat, the infamous Brat Prince, brazenly revealed the blood genesis through his autobiographical books and rock performances. His actions awakened Akasha from her millennia-long slumber. She arose with grandiose visions of reshaping humanity through selective slaughter, particularly targeting males. This crisis brought about a confrontation with the ancient twins. Maharet, who had maintained connections with her human descendants through the ages, attempted diplomatic reasoning, while the long-lost Makare, now feral from centuries of isolation, emerged to fulfill an ancient prophecy by decapitating Akasha and consuming her brain, thereby absorbing the sacred core and becoming the new Queen of the Damned. This shared origin story transformed vampire society, creating bonds between immortals who had previously existed in isolation. They developed a rich lexicon to describe their existence, calling themselves blood drinkers or children of the millennia rather than vampires. Their supernatural abilities became known as gifts, the cloud gift for flight and levitation, the fire gift for pyrokinesis, the mind gift for telepathic abilities, and many others. They viewed the mortal world as the savage garden, a place of beautiful but merciless natural law. This common language and shared history helped forge a complex culture among beings who had previously known only solitude, secrecy, and individual survival. Lestat, now prince of the vampire world, finds himself plagued by recurring dreams of a magnificent city falling into the sea. Visions that arrive with devastating clarity each time he enters his daytime sleep. These aren't ordinary nightmares, but vivid historical echoes, accompanied by the agonized cries of thousands dying and flames that seem to outshine heaven itself. The dreams unfold with cinematic precision, crystalline towers shattering like glass, streets flooding with seawater turned crimson with blood, and the desperate faces of inhabitants whose features seem hauntingly familiar, yet impossibly ancient. What makes these visions particularly disturbing is that Lestat isn't alone in experiencing them. Other vampires across the globe report similar dreams, each describing identical details. The peculiar architecture combining geometric precision with organic flowing forms, the strange symbols etched into the walls, and most notably, the distinctive pale blue-white stone used in the city's construction. This shared experience suggests either a collective memory embedded in vampire DNA or a psychic event powerful enough to transcend time itself. When Lestat questions Amel, the spirit entity now residing within him as the sacred core connecting all vampires, about these visions, he encounters a complex web of evasion and emotion. Initially, Amel denies sharing the dreams with his characteristic dismissiveness. However, during their mental conversations, Lestat catches glimpses of Amel's true reactions, trembling, psychic withdrawal, and eventually reluctant admission that he too sees the falling city. More telling is Amel's emotional response. Lestat senses genuine fear and hears the spirit weeping when images of the city appear in their shared consciousness, particularly when certain buildings come into focus, especially a grand temple complex at the city's heart. Their unique bond, Lestat containing the sacred core that links all vampires, creates an intimacy unlike any other, allowing him to perceive Amel's reactions with unprecedented clarity. Yet this connection is fraught with tension and uncertainty. Amel's reluctance to discuss the city suggests not just knowledge, but personal investment in its fate. When pressed, he describes towers of pale azure and pink and gold, with flower-lined streets before falling silent in apparent pain. His descriptions carry the weight of first-hand experience rather than second-hand knowledge, suggesting these might be memories rather than prophetic visions. This mystery forms the central tension driving the narrative forward, raising profound questions about vampire origins. Why would an ancient spirit entity be traumatized by the destruction of a city? What connection could Amel have to a place that seems to predate even the oldest vampire's memories? The answers lie buried in a past so ancient it predates written history, in a civilization whose very existence challenges everything the vampires thought they knew about themselves and their origins. The falling city represents not just a historical tragedy, but potentially the key to understanding the true nature of vampire kind and their purpose in the world. The vampire world's stability is shattered by the appearance of beings who look human, but clearly are not. The first sign comes when Derek, imprisoned beneath Budapest by the vampire Roland, is recognized as something extraordinary. "He's not human," Rashomondes exclaims upon seeing him. Roland confirms this, suggesting Derek has existed longer than either vampire, a startling revelation considering vampires measure their ages in centuries and millennia. This discovery sends shockwaves through the vampire community, challenging their long-held belief that they were the planet's apex immortal beings. These mysterious beings possess remarkable abilities that defy both natural and supernatural laws. When Rashomondes severs Derek's arm in torture, the wound miraculously heals, sealing itself completely without leaving even a scar. More astonishingly, the severed limb itself begins to move independently, crawling across the floor toward Derek with fingers propelling it forward, displaying an eerie intelligence and purpose. This limb eventually regenerates into a perfect duplicate of Derek, his son, Dirtu, distinguished only by subtle golden streaks in his hair. The process occurs with frightening speed, taking mere hours rather than the days or weeks that even vampire healing requires. What makes these beings particularly dangerous is their ability to multiply through dismemberment, each severed part potentially becoming a new individual, effectively making them impossible to destroy through conventional means. This reproductive capability, combined with their apparent immortality and immunity to most forms of harm, presents an existential threat unlike any the vampires have faced before. They can survive decapitation, dismemberment, and even complete immolation, regenerating from the smallest remaining piece. As Farid warns Lestat telepathically after meeting them, they are the most dangerous threat to this planet I have ever known. His warning carries special weight given his scientific background and typically measured approach to new phenomena. Yet despite their alien nature, these beings display recognizably human emotions that add layers of complexity to their characterization. Derek weeps with joy upon meeting his son, displaying paternal love that mirrors human familial bonds. Kapetria shows unexpected compassion toward vampires, despite their predatory nature, often intervening to prevent unnecessary violence. Garrikin expresses deep appreciation for human culture and art, spending hours in museums and concert halls, suggesting these beings aren't simply infiltrators, but observers fascinated by humanity's achievements. Most disturbing for the vampires is these beings' apparent knowledge of Amel. They speak his name with the familiarity of old acquaintances, seek him specifically among all the vampires, and seem to understand aspects of his nature that even he claims to have forgotten. Their presence forces the vampire world to confront uncomfortable questions about their own origins. If Amel isn't simply a spirit, as they believed, what is he? And what connection do these non-humans to the recurring dreams of a falling city that haunts so many vampires? These dreams, previously dismissed as shared memories, take on new significance as possible clues to an ancient history that preceded even vampire kind. The appearance of these beings represents not just a physical threat, but an existential crisis for vampire society, challenging everything they thought they knew about their place in the world's hierarchy and the true nature of their own origins. Lestat's transition from rebellious outcast to reluctant ruler forms a compelling arc throughout the novel. The former brat prince now finds himself responsible for the entire vampire species, forced to make decisions that will affect all of his kind. This burden weighs heavily on him, as he confesses during a moment of melancholy. I am alone, I am alone, I am alone. Amel is with me night and day, yet I am alone. The court itself represents a dramatic evolution in vampire society. For millennia, these immortals lived in isolation or small covens, distrustful and territorial. Now they gather in the restored Chateau de Lioncourt, forming committees, debating policies, and creating a constitution under Marius's guidance. This unprecedented cooperation stems from necessity. They face threats that no individual vampire, no matter how powerful, could handle alone. Lestat's leadership style reflects his complex personality. He remains impulsive and passionate, yet shows surprising wisdom in delegating authority to those with specific expertise. Farid and Seth handle scientific matters, Marius provides historical perspective, and Gregory manages business affairs. When confronted with the mysterious non-humans, Lestat demonstrates remarkable restraint, choosing diplomacy over destruction, despite the potential threat they represent. The court faces multiple crises simultaneously. The appearance of non-human beings with unknown intentions, Rochamondis's rebellion after killing the ancient Maharet, and the growing realization that Amel himself may not be what they thought. These challenges test not only Lestat's leadership, but the very foundation of their newly formed society. Can beings who have lived for centuries as predatory individualists truly form a functioning community? Can ancient grudges be set aside for the common good? Most poignantly, Lestat must navigate his complex relationship with Louis, his former fledgling and eternal love. When Lestat admits simply, "I need Louis," we see the vulnerability beneath the princely facade. Their reconciliation provides emotional stability amid chaos, with Louis promising, "Whither thou goest, I will go. Thy people shall be my people. You shall be my God." This biblical reference underscores the quasi-religious nature of Lestat's position as prince. He has become, for better or worse, the focal point of vampire faith and identity. Capetria's tale transforms our understanding of both Amel and the legendary Atlantis. Speaking to the assembled vampire court, she reveals that 12,000 years ago, she and her companions were created as replimoids, organic beings developed from a blend of Earth's life forms to resemble humans, but with fundamentally different neural circuitry. Their creators, whom they called the parents, were tall, thin beings with white faces, round black eyes, and lipless mouths, clearly extraterrestrial in origin. The parents explained that these replimoids were designed to be unkillable and renewable, created for a specific purpose, to infiltrate Earth where mammals had gained dominance, something the Realm of Worlds considered abhorrent. Their mission was to enter Atlantia, a magnificent domed city rising from the sea, and ultimately trigger a catastrophe that would reset Earth's evolution to favor reptiles and birds over mammals. Most shockingly, Capetria reveals Amel's true nature. He was himself a superior replimoid created by the parents with vast knowledge and sent to Earth to destroy violent primates with a plague. Designed with pale skin, green eyes, and red hair to be perceived as a god by primitive humans, Amel betrayed his makers. Instead of fulfilling his mission, he destroyed the transmitting stations, never released the plague, and even immunized Earth species against it. Atlantia, the true Atlantis, was Amel's creation, a magnificent city of translucent towers where his chosen humans lived in prosperity. The city featured technology far beyond its time, moving sidewalks, electric stairways rising 3 stories high, self-driving pods, and buildings made of translucent material that could become opaque with a wave of the hand. Most remarkable was Amel's ability to plant tower seeds that, when touched by sunlight, grew spectacularly into complete skyscrapers while musicians played and crowds sang. This revelation transforms our understanding of vampire origins. Amel was not simply a spirit, as vampires believed for millennia, but a physical being from another world who became pure consciousness after his physical form was destroyed. The recurring dreams of a falling city were actually Amel's memories of Atlantia's destruction, the catastrophe engineered by the parents when their replimoid agents finally succeeded in their mission. The truth about Atlantis bridges science fiction with supernatural horror, suggesting that the vampires themselves are the product of alien intervention gone awry. What began as an attempt to destroy humanity instead created a new immortal species that would walk alongside humans throughout history, predators yet preservers of human culture and knowledge. For millennia, all vampires existed in a mystical network connected through Amel's consciousness. When the ancient queen Akasha was destroyed, this network nearly collapsed before Amel found a new host in Makare. Now, with Amel residing in Lestat, the vampires debate a radical experiment, temporarily stopping Lestat's heart to see if they can safely disconnect all vampires from Amel without destroying him. The theory, articulated by Lewis using theosophical concepts, suggests that each vampire could become a discrete entity with their own etheric body and brain. This would free them from the existential vulnerability of being linked to a single host. If Lestat were destroyed, they wouldn't all perish as was long feared with Akasha. However, it would also fundamentally change what it means to be a vampire, severing the mystical connection that has defined their species since its inception. The experiment proceeds with Farid administering an injection to stop Lestat's heart, while Louis and Grent stand by to revive him. As his heart stops, Lestat is transported to a sunlit room with a glass dome, where Amel, appearing with red hair brighter than Lestat's and distinct green eyes, welcomes him to Atalantia. This vision confirms Amel's connection to the Lost City and provides Lestat a glimpse of what was lost, a magnificent glass metropolis with buildings changing shape, gardens on rooftops, and children dancing in circles. When Lestat's heart restarts, they discovered the experiment worked. Every vampire felt a shock when his heart stopped, but recovered within minutes. Despite initial panic throughout the vampire world, no vampire experiences deterioration or loss of powers. The cloud gift, fire gift, and mind gift remain intact across the tribe. A new fledgling is even successfully created in Oxford, proving the species can continue without the central connection. However, Amel remains bound solely to Lestat, unable to travel into other minds as before. This creates a precarious situation. Amel is now trapped within Lestat alone, making the prince both uniquely powerful and uniquely vulnerable. If the Replimoids succeed in extracting Amel from Lestat, what would become of the prince? Could he survive such a procedure, or would he perish like Akasha and Makare before him? The climax comes when Capatria finally calls Lestat, requesting to meet out in the open in front of Notre Dame just before dawn. She admits planning to free Amel, but cannot guarantee Lestat won't be harmed. Despite his reluctance, Lestat agrees to meet her, only to be captured by Rochamondes, who sees this as reparation for past wrongs. Capatria's plan is revealed. At sunrise, when Lestat is unconscious, she'll replace his blood with Replimoid blood, open his skull, and attempt to remove Amel into another prepared body. Despite rescue attempts by his loyal followers, Lestat surrenders to prevent harm to his friends. When he awakens alone in a hospital room afterward, he discovers himself completely alone. No presence inside him, no voice speaking to him. Amel is gone. In addressing the vampire court about Amel's absence, Lestat urges them to make their way of life sacred through their own faith, as no outside power can sanctify them. He reminds them that those who survived centuries did so because they cared about something greater than themselves and thirsted for knowledge and beauty despite witnessing everything they cherished fade away. This philosophical reflection marks Lestat's growth from rebellious individualist to thoughtful leader. The true resolution comes unexpectedly. While in Paris with Louis, Lestat notices someone watching him intently, a young man with suntanned skin, deep red hair, and bright green eyes. It's Amel, reborn in a perfect replica of his original Atlantean body. Their reunion is emotional, with both weeping at the miracle of their meeting. Amel explains how Capatria created his body from cells in her hands, how he had to learn everything anew, seeing, walking, talking. Though his Replimoid guardians allow him only brief independence, they share an hour of conversation about history, science, and Amel's plans to explore the world. When they part, Lestat shares his blood with Amel in a final kiss, tasting Amel's innocent blood, sweet, fresh, powerful, and feeling a rush of images from his new existence. They promise to meet again, suggesting that despite their separation, their bond transcends physical connection. The revelation of Amel's true nature and the existence of Atalantia fundamentally transforms the vampire's understanding of themselves. What they thought was supernatural in origin, their immortality, their powers, their very existence, turns out to have roots in extraterrestrial science. Yet this scientific explanation doesn't diminish the spiritual questions that have haunted them throughout their long existences. In a heated argument between Amel and Maxim, theorized to be the entity later known as Memnoch, we see competing philosophical perspectives on existence itself. Maxim believes in a higher maker and argues that life in Atalantia was too easy, robbing people of spiritual growth through struggle. Amel counters passionately that all sentient, self-conscious beings with moral sense have souls, regardless of their origin. This debate echoes throughout vampire existence. Are they soulless predators or beings capable of moral growth and spiritual development? Lestat's journey from rebellious fledgling to reluctant prince to separated individual reflects the central theme of finding meaning in immortality. Without Amel's presence inside him, Lestat must redefine himself once again. His observation that to love even one person truly is the beginning of wisdom suggests that meaning comes not from power or longevity, but from connection and compassion. The novel ends with a powerful image. Atalantia, with its shimmering towers, was evidence of Amel's fathomless capacity for love. This reframes the entire vampire mythology. What began as violence and blood has evolved into a complex meditation on love, belonging, and purpose. The vampires, once isolated predators, have formed a community. Amel, once a disembodied spirit, has regained physical form. Even Rashomandes, consumed by revenge, finds reconciliation possible. In the end, Rice suggests that immortality's greatest challenge isn't surviving physically, but maintaining emotional and spiritual vitality across the centuries. The vampires who endured did so because they cared about something greater than themselves and thirsted for knowledge and beauty, despite witnessing everything they cherished fade away. This capacity to find meaning and beauty in an endless existence, to love the savage garden despite its cruelty, is perhaps the true legacy of Atlantis, a civilization that valued beauty and harmony enough to build translucent towers reaching toward the sky.